It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, UW campuses like Oshkosh and Milwaukee are facing challenges in their budgets. We'll find out how UW system schools are dealing with those challenges amid declining enrollment and changes in state support. First, we take our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. We continue to hear dueling stories about the likely killing of a journalist after visiting the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey. President Trump's re-election campaign has raised a lot of money with 2 years still to go. And after the Republican tax overhaul went into effect, the federal deficit has jumped sharply in the last fiscal year. That's our question of the week. Is the size of the national debt and annual budget deficit something that bothers you? Does it motivate your vote? What do you think would be the best way to reduce it? Less spending on things like Medicare and Social Security or increased tax revenue? Do you think Congress will act in either direction? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. David Lauder is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be with you.
Well, on Monday, President Trump spoke about a conversation he had with King Salman of Saudi Arabia. Here's a bit of what he had to say to reporters.
I can only tell you that his denial to me was just one very, relatively fast phone call, probably lasted 20 minutes. His denial to me could not have been stronger, that he had no knowledge, and it sounded like he and also the Crown Prince had no knowledge.
A lot has happened since then, David. The Turkish press, government-backed press in many cases, saying there are recordings of this journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, being murdered in the embassy. What's the latest on this in Washington and in Congress?
Well, as you said, the reports coming out of Turkey have been increasingly detailed and increasingly grisly about Khashoggi's disappearance and apparent murder. There has been mounting calls in Congress, including a number of Republican senators, Lindsey Graham being the most outspoken, but others as well, Marco Rubio, for example, saying that if this is true and suggesting that they think it is true, that the U.S. will have to punish Saudi Arabia in some form, saying that if the U.S. doesn't take a strong stand against this kind of killing, that America will lose its moral credibility to object to misbehavior by other countries. The administration doesn't seem to be taking that position. So there is a rift that's potentially developing here between the administration and Republicans in Congress over how to deal with this. At least so far, the president has talked about the Saudi denials. He says he gives them credence. Very few people on Capitol Hill seem to be sharing that position. So there potentially is a collision coming here, although right now, at least in Washington, both sides are somewhat distracted by the midterm election coming up.
You mentioned Senator Lindsey Graham. Let's give a listen to him talking about the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the effective ruler, it seems like, in Saudi Arabia. Here's a listen.
This all originated from the Crown Prince. I'm convinced of that. The president needs to be measured. I get that. But the world is watching us. They're not going to join Iran in Saudi Arabia. There are plenty of people in Saudi Arabia that we could have a good relationship with. But if the Crown Prince stays in power, it will be almost impossible to reconstruct this relationship at a time both of us need it.
So you mentioned very different approaches from senators, Republican senators like Lindsey Graham and the Republican president, Donald Trump. We have this long relationship the United States does with Saudi Arabia through better and worse. Is this something that is really going to flare up and cause tension between Senate Republicans and the president?
I think it could, yes. And again, a lot could depend on how the midterm elections turn out, because that colors the entire environment in which these folks are operating. But, Khashoggi is someone who is very well known in Washington. A number of the senators had known him, had met him, had talked with him. So it's not an abstract thing in their minds. And, you know, the United States tends to not pay a whole lot of attention to atrocities that occur in other countries. But in this case, even though, as the president has said on a couple of occasions now, Khashoggi is not an American citizen, he was a resident of Virginia. He was someone who was quite well known in Washington. He was a columnist for the Washington Post. So there are a lot of people in Washington on both sides of the aisle for whom this is personal. And I don't think they're likely to easily drop it. And then you add to that the fact that people already had a lot of questions about the Crown Prince, about whether this new Saudi leadership was too reckless, too unwilling to listen to outsiders who were saying that they were doing the wrong thing in other situations, such as the war that's been going on between Saudi Arabia and its neighbor Yemen, in which thousands of civilians have been killed. So there were already have been these doubts about how reliable an ally is this guy. And this kind of action, in which, if the reports are accurate, they deliberately murdered an American resident journalist in a consulate because he was a dissident. That really, is the sort of thing that makes people think these aren't good people to be relying on.
Talking to David Lauder, Washington Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. It's our weekly review of the top stories in national politics. Moving on to the federal deficit. David, new numbers out on the deficit in the last fiscal year. People have been watching this closely since the Republican tax overhaul went into effect. What did we see happen to tax revenues and then the deficit this year?
Well, the deficit's gotten a lot worse. At the time the tax bill passed, Republicans said that it wouldn't add to the deficit, or if it did, it would be only a small amount and a temporary thing. That has proven to be untrue. The increase in the deficit is significant, and tax revenues actually went down for the first time in a number of years. The long-term outlook for the deficit is bad. It was going down year by year. Obviously, it reached a big peak right after the recession, as deficits typically go up. But from that point, it had been going steadily down and was on a glide path to end up at a fairly low and manageable level. But now that's been pretty dramatically turned around, and it's going up with no real end in sight.
Let's give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about that deficit news this week.
It's very disturbing, and it's driven by the three big entitlement programs that are very popular: Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. That's 70% of what we spend every year. The subject we were just discussing, the funding of the government, is about 30% of what we spend. There's been a bipartisan reluctance to tackle entitlement changes because of the popularity of those programs.
So Mitch McConnell saying it's the entitlements, it's those big programs. Is there any kind of appetite in Washington to tackle those?
No. I mean, President Trump has pretty much taken that off the table, as McConnell has said. But McConnell and other Republican leaders like to talk about the deficit in terms of spending too much. But Democrats would say, we're not really spending much more than we were spending. The problem that's driving the deficit now isn't that we're spending more, it's that we're bringing in less. So from the Democrats' standpoint, the problem isn't that Social Security and Medicare need to be cut, it's that taxes need to be increased on those who benefited from the tax cut. So the two sides frame this issue very, very differently. And the prospect for any kind of agreement between them right now is pretty remote.
Let's bring on a caller now. Kyle is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Kyle, hello.
Hey, thanks for getting me on. I agree 100% with the tax cut. The Democrats go ahead and want to tax us to death. They don't want to stop their spending. I don't believe that Social Security is a welfare program. We paid into that for all our lives. I'm 50 years old, and this is the best job market I've ever seen. I think it's time to address the issues of the welfare programs for generations of people that refuse to work, and we keep giving them money. I'd like to see that put to an end. There's chances for jobs, and if you really want to work, we're here in Iowa. We got excellent job market. If you want a job, you can have a job.
Kyle, thanks a lot for the call. Kyle says tax cuts, good. Social Security, don't touch it. Wants some welfare reform, he says. How much of a difference? There are other philosophical issues with work and public assistance programs. How big a dent would that put in the deficit, though, David?
It would not put a significant dent in the deficit. As Senator McConnell said in that clip you played just a moment ago, 70% of what the government spends goes to Social Security, Medicare, and other spending on that primarily goes to senior citizens. So, you can, as many people do, you can argue that taxes shouldn't go up. That's fine. You can argue that Social Security shouldn't be cut. You can argue that the deficit is a bad thing. You can't really argue all three of those. You kind of have to take your pick. If you're going to cut the deficit, either the government will have to spend less money on Social Security and Medicare, or the government will have to raise taxes. There isn't an easy third choice that is going to get you out of the problem, because even if you zeroed out programs like food stamps, for example, the amount of money you saved would not be enough to deal with these mounting deficits. Medicaid is a very large program, but at this point, the bulk of money under Medicaid goes, again, to elderly Americans. It pays for a lot of nursing homes. It pays for other forms of care for elderly people. The amount of money in Medicaid that goes to younger people is now the minority part, most of those are children. So the amount of money going to working age people is a pretty small slice of the overall pie. So there's a dilemma here that by and large both parties have done a pretty good job of not telling the truth to voters about the choice.
Talking to David Lauder from the Los Angeles Times, looking at some of the top national political news of the week. Still time for you to weigh in on 800-642-1234 on the deficit issue. Is this something you worry about? Does it affect how you vote? What solutions do you look for? More income? More taxes? Decreased spending? Just decrease spending on what then? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with David Lauder, Washington Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, talking about this week's political news. Want to hear a couple of your calls on these deficit and budget issues. Lori is with us in Vernon County. Lori, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. For the past, 50 years, 40 years, workers' wages have been stagnant. The wealthy have been becoming ever more wealthy. We are at the largest inequality in a century, practically. If workers had been receiving wages, wage increases in the last 50 years, the Social Security Fund would not be in trouble. We never talk about where the money has been going in these conversations. And also for McConnell to say that 70% of the budget goes to these entitlement programs, well, Social Security and Medicare are taken out of our paychecks. It's not coming out of the general fund. So thank you.
Lori, thanks for the call. I want to bring on Charlie in Milwaukee now. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I believe when we were discussing the tax cut that was proposed, they assumed a GDP of 3%. The fact that we are now getting a GDP of 4% and increased revenues in through taxation, isn't that going to mitigate the cost of the tax cut and decrease the deficit overall?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Before we move on from the deficit issue, David, Lori connected the economy to the deficit, saying workers not getting pay increases. That's been taking a bite out of Social Security money coming in. Charlie saying the hope that an improved economy brings in more revenue that's going to lower the deficit. Both arguments that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's true that by and large, the wages for average workers peaked in the late 1970s and have been pretty stagnant since. So that has definitely been a problem, and it has affected the Social Security financing. As for, you know, rapid economic growth, we haven't actually hit 4%, at least not on an annual basis, and most forecasts suggest that we'll be back to about 2% next year. So, you know, if the economy grows really, really fast, then everything financially gets much better. You know, that's a bit like a family saying, you know, if I get a really big pay increase, I'll be able to afford this larger house. It's risky to bet on it.
Thanks a lot for your calls. We are talking about the top stories in national politics. David Lauder is with us. And David, I want to move on to a few more issues before our conversation ends. You wrote recently about the Senate, the U.S. Senate races in the midterm elections. Talk about the tough challenge for Democrats who are hoping to gain those magic two seats to gain a majority.
Yeah, I mean, most of the races that are up for grabs this year, there are 35 Senate seats up for grabs this year, but most of them are pretty one-sided. The ones that are actually competitive are mostly seats that Democrats hold in extremely conservative states or fairly conservative states. And they're not doing very well. So unlike the House, where Democrats have a really good chance of retaking the majority, in the Senate, Democrats maybe, possibly, if they get a lot of lucky breaks, might be able to win the majority. But more likely, they may actually lose a seat or two on balance. Because you're dealing with, you know, some pretty conservative places like West Virginia and North Dakota and Montana and Indiana and Missouri, where it's hard for a Democrat to win, and their chances of defending all of those incumbent Democratic senators in states that Trump carried, that's a tall order.
And I've seen a lot of lists, including yours, of races to watch that could flip. I'm not seeing a lot of people put Wisconsin. We've got incumbent Democrat Tammy Baldwin being challenged by Republican State Senator Leah Vukmir. Polls showing Baldwin ahead, but Donald Trump won the state. Ron Johnson won for Republicans for a second time in 2016. Wisconsin, though, doesn't seem to be on people's radars.
It doesn't. A year ago, Republican consultants were saying Tammy Baldwin's in trouble. This is a state that we should be able to win. You don't hear that very much from Republican strategists anymore. They're hoping that that they can hold on to, you know, that Governor Walker can hold on and get reelected, but it doesn't seem terribly likely that Baldwin is going to lose. And, you know, Wisconsin has probably the biggest ideological separation between its two senators of any state in the country. It's a remarkable thing how different Baldwin and Ron Johnson are. So the idea that the state could elect two such very different people in two successive elections is pretty startling, but that's the nature of the state.
Now, that election's 20 days away. I don't want to be that guy, but the presidential election is coming up in 2020. President Trump has a ways off. He's already had some impressive, what sound like impressive, fundraising numbers, over $100 million for that campaign. Is that something we usually see this far out?
No, Trump has definitely started fundraising earlier than other presidents have, and he's had quite a lot of success, as you noted. But, you know, raising money was never really going to be his problem. He's going to have the money that he needs to run. I think the question with Trump's reelection will be whether he can hold on to those voters in places like Wisconsin, who put him over the top. And I think that's very much an open question. You know, you have to assume if a guy won once that he can win twice. But that victory in 2016 was a very, very narrow win. You know, a few tens of thousands of votes in just a handful of states, including Wisconsin, would have flipped it the other way. So it's going to be a very closely fought contest again, I think. I mean, that it certainly, as it looks right now, things could change. But, you know, you'd have to bet on a another high-profile, high-decibel, lots of shouting, very polarized election.
We'll leave it there for now. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
That's David Lauder, Washington Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. He was with us for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can still weigh in on your question for you in this edition of The Week in Washington. Are you worried about the deficit, the federal deficit, gone up in a recent fiscal report? Are you worried about it? Do you vote based on that? What would you do to fix it? Let us know via Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR with your thoughts. The University of Wisconsin system has faced some financial challenges in recent years. Most notably, campuses, including UW-Oshkosh and UW-Milwaukee, have had to make cuts to staff and faculty and services to remain financially solvent. Our next guest is here to talk about some of the steps these campuses have taken to keep their heads figuratively above water in the midst of, in many cases, declining enrollment. Karen Herzog is the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Karen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, before we visit particular campuses, Karen, you write about some structural challenges that the system is facing. One of those, there are fewer high school graduates. There's a lower population of people enrolling in colleges. Can you talk about how that can put a strain on a campus?
Well, if you think about enrollment as tuition revenue, and you think about what actually pays for the cost of instruction, what pays faculty, support staff, all of those people that are responsible for educating students, if you have fewer students, you have less tuition. And tuition and state revenue together pay for instructional costs. There also have been large cuts in state funding. So all of those things together create quite a hole for universities to dig themselves out from. And for example, UW-Milwaukee had a $24 million gap between budgeted tuition expenditures and actual tuition revenue last fiscal year. And the only campus that didn't have a gap between money coming in and money going out for instructional costs was UW-Madison.
Right. UW-Madison, in a way, has a relief valve that others don't. They can bring in out-of-state students, out-of-country students in some cases, who pay higher tuition. That can is that a part of how they balance the books?
That's huge for UW-Madison. UW-Madison also has not experienced a drop in enrollment. There are only a couple of campuses that actually increased their numbers this fall, and they're really small increases. UW-Madison, on the other hand, has the ability to, you know, no matter how bad their situation is, they always have a deep pool of applicants, lots of people who want to go to the state's flagship university. And they have, as you suggested, increased tuition for out-of-state students, for international students, and they've grown the freshman class basically by adding more seats for out-of-state students who pay much higher tuition.
Now, you focused in your reporting on, as you mentioned, UW-Milwaukee. So you mentioned the budget gaps they've faced. What has that meant in terms of hiring, retention, and classes?
Well, the implications for the loss of revenue are wide and varied, and campuses have been dealing with this for some years now, since the big cuts in 2015, and so it's an ongoing concern. But more recently, with the declining enrollment numbers, there have had to be adjustments with programs, as you suggested. You know, at UWM, for example, some concentration areas within majors have been dropped. And also trying to redirect money to programs that draw more students, because if you're trying to attract more students, you want to, you know, beef up the programs that have higher demand and that the workforce demand is for. But UWM has lost about 15% of its faculty since the fall of 2014, and basically they froze positions, did not replace faculty who retired or took jobs elsewhere, and that was one way for them to save money. And, of course, also at the same time, they lost about 10% of student enrollment since 2010. So, again, it's all of those factors that come into play that together mean less money and more difficult decisions.
Is there a fear of a downward spiral, fewer students, less tuition, leading to program cuts? Parents and prospective students hear about those cuts and think maybe that's not at the top of our list?
Well, that certainly is something that campuses are talking about, and it has gradually been happening. You've heard about UW-Stevens Point talking more dramatically about cutting majors. All campuses, to some degree, have made adjustments through the years. When they have lower interest in certain majors, they may redirect faculty, but not necessarily dropping a major, but redirecting them to areas where there's more demand. But certainly, like, for example, at UWM, there have been classes that have been dropped, you know, that would give you a concentration, like, for example, in jazz performance in the School of Music. Again, it follows what the enrollment numbers are. It follows what the demand is for the workforce, politics to some degree, STEM field growth. So it's a lot of factors that come into play.
Talking to higher education reporter Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about some of the budget challenges facing campuses around the state and how they're reacting to those challenges. We're also hearing UW Oshkosh having financial issues. What are they doing to try to stay afloat there?
Well, Oshkosh has lost over 100 positions, faculty positions, over the last 4 years. So they've been experiencing some of the same pressures that UWM has experienced. They also have lost about 1,800 undergraduates in the last 5 years, although their enrollment is slightly up this year. But again, you know, those 1,800 undergrads that they didn't have enroll, that's $10 million in lost revenue. The other factor that's coming into play is when you improve graduation rates, you get more students through quicker, that's fewer students that are paying, you know, tuition for you, and you have to replace them in the next class. UW Oshkosh, I think, is also looking for perhaps reducing the number of classes offered in some areas, increasing at least temporarily the workload, the teaching hours in the College of Letters and Science, although that's supposed to be temporary. They are also looking at non-renewal of like adjunct instructor contracts. There hasn't really been any talk of any layoffs on any campuses per se. It's mostly attrition and freezing positions when people leave.
We've mostly been talking about tuition revenue here. You mentioned earlier another part of the story is state support. Can you talk about trends in state support for these campuses over the last bunch of years?
Well, state support has certainly not increased with any significance. There's been some targeted increases in funding, but overall the trend has definitely been less state support and more reliance on tuition revenue. With the state budget, biennial budget discussions starting up in a few months, of course, this is a big topic of discussion and a big topic for the UW system to try to win the support of state lawmakers to hopefully increase funding and also perhaps take the tuition freeze off the table. The tuition has been frozen for undergrad residents for 6 years now, and that, of course, is a big loss of additional revenue if the campuses can't raise tuition. And that, of course, as you know, was prompted by 5 or 6 years of 5.5% increases in a row prior to the freeze. So there are a lot of factors on the table.
as you report on this, what's the sense you get from these campuses? Is this, okay, we've got a rough patch, we'll make some tweaks and get through? Is it, this is an existential crisis, or somewhere in between?
It depends on who you ask. At UWM, for example, administrators will say, you know, we are strategically managing this. You know, we're making smart decisions based on, you know, interest in academic areas and higher demand majors. Faculty, on the other hand, at UWM are very concerned about whether losing talented faculty and replacing them with adjunct instructors who do not do research could put the R1 research status, the highest category of research status that they gained in 2015, that could be in jeopardy if the labor force is eroded at the university.
Now, once upon a time, I'm thinking back to probably the Tommy Thompson era as governor, there might be a blue ribbon commission to kind of take these problems apart, maybe look at some fundamental changes. Is anybody talking in that way, big picture, we need to rethink, take another look at the mission and funding sources for our UW system?
I certainly hear that from faculty members. There are a lot of faculty across the UW system who are concerned that there isn't a big picture look at this, that there does need to be a blue ribbon commission that's been to be formed. There hasn't been any discussion of that happening at the state level or UW system calling for such a thing. You know, there are task forces that are developed, you know, as needed to look at certain things in particular campuses. But a blue ribbon commission is not something that I've heard mentioned as a priority or as something that we could be seeing in the next fiscal year.
In our last few moments, is this something that is affecting the student experience at campuses like UW-Milwaukee, UW-Oshkosh, some of the others we've talked about?
I think that it's hard to say. It varies depending on departments. If you're in a department that has strong enrollment, there's probably, you know, the same number of classes that you're used to seeing in departments, you know, letters and sciences, for example. If you have a loss of faculty, you're going to have a cut in the number of class sections offered, or there may be fewer courses. There may not be the higher level courses. They may be rotated to only once a year rather than twice a year, which could slow down your path to the degree. So there are things that students may notice, but it's going to be in specific areas that have been harder hit.
We'll leave it there for now. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joins us today to give us an update on the financial health of the UW system and how some campuses around the state are dealing with budget challenges. As the Milwaukee Brewers work to punch their ticket to the World Series, the Milwaukee Bucks are just getting started on their potential return to the NBA playoffs. They tip off their 2018-19 season tonight against the Charlotte Hornets. After losing in the first round of playoffs last year, there's some buzz surrounding this year's team. Giannis Antetokounmpo, the team's superstar, is back. A new coach is in charge, and they've got a brand new home. Matt Velazquez is the Bucks beat reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to Central Time producer Bill Martins.
So is this going to be that breakout year we've been waiting for a few years now?
For the Bucks overall, I think so. I mean, I think that this team has the tools, the players, the coaching staff, everything in line to be a team that flirts with 50 wins. You know, I think that, you know, by any measure, they should be able to get to 50 wins. They were a 44-win team last year, and they have you know, better coaching staff and a better supporting cast around Giannis, and that should be worth six games or so. So when you put it all together, I think this could be a year that the Bucks finish, you know, and probably the top four of the East would be their goal, and then have home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs. See if they can finally break that. You know, by then it'll be 18-year streak of, you know, going one and done in the playoffs.
So Jason Kidd was fired as head coach in the middle of last season. Joe Prunty, one of their assistants, took over on an interim basis. Then they went out and got Mike Budenholzer, who had some pretty good success leading Atlanta. What can you tell us about him?
Well, I mean, he's a proven NBA coach. He spent a long time coaching under Greg Popovich in San Antonio. Then when he finally, you know, decided to strike out on his own and become a head coach, he was basically 2 years on the job before he became the NBA's Coach of the Year with that 60-win Hawks team that he led, you know, group of guys that they had. You know, the talent, they'd already been there for a couple of years, but he helped them develop into, you know, a dynamic unit together where they could be a fearsome offensive team, locked down on defense. And, you know, they had basically five All-Stars in their starting lineup because no one could figure out exactly who the star was. And now he comes to a team in Milwaukee where he can kind of employ a similar system, but now he does have a star. I mean, everybody knows Giannis Antetokounmpo is a star in the NBA at this point in his career, and he's still getting better. So you put the right players around him, guys who can space the floor, shoot threes, you know, defend at a high level. And it just opens things up for him more. So I think that's what Budenholzer is trying to bring. And so far, the early response from the players has been really good. They like him and his coaching staff and the way that, you know, that he's built them up and he's taught them and got them, you know, totally buying into his system.
So is Budenholzer the last big piece of the Bucks puzzle to steal a headline? From one of your pieces?
You know, I think he could be. He could be. I mean, you look at, they already have guys, you know, one of the main reasons they fired Jason Kidd last year is because the front office and ownership believed they had the talent to win. They believed they had, you know, the right pieces on the court, and they weren't getting enough out of that talent. And I think a lot of fans would watch that and agree. And so if you bring Budenholzer in here, and if he can get them playing all on the same page in the same way with his style, you know, obviously it helps to bring in veterans like Brook Lopez and Ersan Ilyasova, you know, guys who are, you know, proven veterans in the league, who can shoot the three, who know what they're doing, high IQ players. So obviously that helps. But if you can kind of just take everything Budenholzer wants the team to do and maximize the talent the Bucks have, I mean, there's not too much standing in the way of them, you know, really making a jump this season. So I don't know if he's the last piece. Obviously, they want to be a championship contending team, and I don't know if they're necessarily there yet. Maybe they need another player here or there, a couple, you know, tweaks and upgrades. But I think right now they have a really good squad to definitely improve over last year.
You mentioned Giannis Antetokounmpo, and he seems to have been working on his outside shooting during this preseason, especially from beyond the arc. How huge would that be if he can add that to his repertoire?
That's massive. I mean, in the words of his teammate, Brook Lopez, who's played against him for a number of years, he said, man, you know, that makes him terrifying. And he was already scared. Or it's scary and he's already terrifying. Either way, the phrase went, you know, you get the idea. But, you know, you're a guy who put up basically like 26, 27 points a game last year without really a great three-point shot. And he could get to the rim whenever he wanted. He knew his spots. He knew where he wanted to go. And he's just strong and athletic enough that guys just can't stop him with all his length and his great ball handling ability. So when you add in the threat of a three-pointer, which, you know, defenses are going to sag off of him because they're afraid of him driving and either scoring himself or kicking out to other shooters, if he can just, you know, pull up for a three instead of driving, one, it's going to save him some wear and tear, and two, if he can make it on a regular basis, that's going to make the Bucks offense even scarier, you know, which is something that, you know, is a major change for the Bucks this year.
We're talking with Matt Velasquez, the Bucks beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we are talking about the 2018-19 Bucks season, which gets underway tonight in Charlotte. Matt, the Bucks haven't had a dominant center in a while. You know, that real big guy who can score down low, get rebounds and block, just be a presence. They kind of had high hopes for Greg Monroe, but that didn't really work out. So during the offseason, they picked up Brook Lopez, who you've mentioned, from the New York Knicks. Now, one story I read said that was the most underrated move of the offseason. What does Brook Lopez bring to the Bucks?
Yeah, I mean, Brook Lopez, I mean, he's been an all-star in the league. You know, he does have that physical size. You know, he's a seven-footer, about 270. You know, he's got that physical size to bang on the boards and, you know, be an anchor on defense. But they're asking him to do a little bit different things than you would expect of somebody that size. You know, over the past two seasons, he's really developed his three-point shot. He's been a 35% three-point shooter the past 2 years on a high volume of shots. And so, you know, what he can do is he can step out on offense, go to the corner, go, you know, above the break, and pull his defender with him. And that just opens up the passing lanes and the driving lanes for guys like Giannis and Eric Bledsoe and Chris Middleton to kind of go to work. And if his defender doesn't go with him, well, then he's liable to just catch that wide-open pass and put up a shot, and he's got a decent chance of making it. So Just kind of a different brand of basketball, different expectation than the Bucks would have for a Brook Lopez type as opposed to Greg Monroe. Monroe, still has some value in the league as a bench scorer, a guy who can go to work in the paint, grab some rebounds, that kind of stuff. But, the way the league is trending, players like Brook Lopez, especially on a one-year deal that fits into the Bucks biannual exception, which is a, pretty small amount of money relative to the market, when you can get a guy like that who can space the floor, shoot threes, and all that, it's huge, and it fits exactly into what Mike Budenholzer wants to do.
In the draft, the Bucks selected guard Dante DiVincenzo from Villanova with the 17th overall pick, I believe. And he's a pretty good shooter, solid from three-point land, and that's an area where the Bucks found themselves lacking over the past few years. How is he expected to contribute?
Well, I think one of the reasons that Mike Budenholzer likes him is that he does a lot of different things well. His shooting in the preseason wasn't that great. He was kind of trying to figure out his range and get his shot going a little bit. And that'll come in time. He was a good shooter in college. But the nice thing for him is that he does a lot of other things that make up for the fact that his shooting might not be where he wants it to be yet. He'll get his hands dirty, jumping in for rebounds and use his athleticism to kind of make some noise inside that way. He makes some nice passes, especially for a rookie, the way he's able to find guys on pocket passes and things like that. He's also a willing, active defender. Obviously, as a rookie, you're going to have some adjustment time when it comes to knowing how to defend guys at the NBA level. But so far, he's shown that he's going to be capable and can fit into Budenholzer's system. And I think Budenholzer trusts him. So I just based off the preseason games, I think he'll get a decent amount of minutes starting the season.
This is the first year the Bucks are playing in the brand new Fiserv Forum. What are your impressions of it so far?
It's beautiful. You look at all the arenas in the league, and this one is, near the top of any list. It has all the amenities that you would want. There's a lot of care put into the design, so it can improve the fan experience. It's a lot better for players than the Bradley Center. There's a lot more space. It's designated space for players. There's not people walking through or game operations people kind of in your way or not trying to stretch in a hallway where pregame interviews are being done, anything like that. You have dedicated space for both teams, and it gets loud in there. And so I know the Bucks are helping to use that as a home court advantage. I personally am interested to see what it sounds like when it's full because I haven't been there when it's full yet. I've been to Bradley Center when it was full, and it got pretty loud. Pretty excited in the playoffs, but we'll have to see if Fiserv Forum can hold up. And I think so far, just the way that they built it, the sound is made to reverb like right down to the court, and the players are really excited about that.
Matt, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
All right, yeah, thanks for having me.
Matt Velazquez is the Bucks beat reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to Central Time producer Bill Martins about the team's upcoming season. They tip off tonight in Charlotte against the Hornets. By the way, there's a governor's race going on, and there's a debate between the two main candidates, Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Tony Evers. They square off Friday night at 8. Join Wisconsin Public Radio for live coverage of the one-hour debate. You can learn about all of our election specials and follow election news at WPR.org and WisconsinVote.org. And then join in again this Friday at 8 for this debate in the race for governor live from Madison. Quick quiz. What do these two characters have in common?
Hi, it's me, Big Bird, and I want to talk to you about asking questions. Now, a question is what you ask somebody when there's something you want to find out.
Great lesson for a talk show host here. Here's character number two.
If you won't beat it, I will. Blech!
Okay, yeah, they're both Muppets from Sesame Street, well done, but also they're played by the same person, and they have been for about 50 years. Sesame Workshop announced this week that Carol Spinney is retiring from his dual roles as Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. Spinney has appeared in literally, and I mean literally, thousands of Sesame Street episodes. About his retirement, he told the New York Times, quote, "I always thought how fortunate for me that I got to play the two best Muppets." He took on the role of Big Bird in 1969. Big Bird was supposed to be a funny, dumb guy character, but Smitty suggested more of a childlike approach who'd learn things along with the kids who were watching the show. He was a professional puppeteer before joining Jim Henson on the show. In a release from Sesame Workshop, Smitty says, quote, "Before I came to Sesame Street, I didn't feel like what I was doing was very important. Big Bird helped me find my purpose. And even as I step down from my roles, I feel I'll always be Big Bird and even Oscar once in a while." The roles of Oscar the Grouch and Big Bird will stick around. They'll be handed off to new puppeteers. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.